So I thank you for inviting me here. So today I will talk about modeling hierarchy of structure formation and organization. And my PhD supervisor always told me to start with the movies so people get interested. So this is a movie of the reorganization process. This movie is made using the simulations we ran recently, one of these simulations, and that will be the main part. A large part of this talk will be about these simulations. And what you basically see here is light, these bright flashes are just stellar light reorganizing the basic formations. Can you hear me?
There you go.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, okay, good. So let's start. So I mainly work on cosmological structure formation, which is basically trying to understand how extremely small deviation, density perturbations of the order of 10 to the minus 5 that you see in the cosmic microwave background, how they evolve and form the large scale complex structures that we see today, which is basically galaxies, stars, and planets. I won't talk too much about stars and planets, but I'll mainly talk about galaxy formation. And this process is mainly mediated by gravity, but you also have modulations from radiation magnetohydrodynamics and star black hole formation and feedback. So this process has been studied, simulated quite a bit, mainly in the last 10 years or so. So I won't go too much into redshift zero kind of results, but I will talk about one particular epoch, which is the epoch of reionization, cosmic dawn and the epoch of reionization. This is the epoch where after the cosmic dark ages, the very first stars and galaxies started to form. And as these very first stars and galaxies form, they emit large amounts of high energy radiation. So what do I mean by high energy? Anything greater than 13.6 electron volts is considered high energy here. And it is important and it is interesting because any photon with energy greater than 13.6 electron volts can knock an electron off the neutral hydrogen atom. And so in this process, it not only ionizes the gas, it also heats the gas up to 10,000 Kelvin. So the universe undergoes a phase transition from being cold and neutral to being hot and ionized. And this is the epoch of reionization. Right. So there are a lot of questions about this epoch of reionization, like what are the sources responsible for this reionization process? Is it stars? Is it black holes? Is it something else? When did this reionization happen? CMB kind of gives you kind of a midpoint of when the reionization happened, although there are some uncertainties there. What is the duration of this process? We generally do not have an idea yet about how extended this process is. And another important question you can ask is, because this process happens at cosmic dawn, it's much more clearer signal. And so can you constrain cosmology like the underlying dark matter physics or dark energy physics using observables from the epoch of reionization itself. On the right here, I show very different models for the reionization process. As you can see, the error bars are quite large, so a large class of models can actually tell you what the error can still fit the data. That's the idea. That's the point. The data is not constraining yet. So how do you model reionization? So as I said, reionization is a very simple process. You have a photon of energy greater than 13.6 electron volts. It knocks off an electron from the hydrogen atom and you ionize it. That's basically reionization. So to first order, you can basically model it using the first equation given above there, which is basically saying, For every hydrogen atom in the universe, you need one photon of energy greater than 13.6 electron volts. That's the simplest equation you can write to model this process. but of course, we know that's not true, because if you have high density gas, then you need more than one photon to actually ionize this gas. Because if you have this high density gas, then the recombination time of that gas can be less than the Hubble time, right? So you can have this gas, you can ionize this gas, but because it's high density, it'll recombine, and then you have to keep ionizing it again and again and again. So you can recast this equation and say, okay, so the number density of photons is number density of hydrogen times 1 plus how many of our recombinations take place in this high density gas, right? So that's the next step of complexity that you add, right, in order to model the reionization process. But of course, you can write this in terms of not just global averages, but you can write this all these terms in terms of both space and time, and then this becomes an extremely complicated process to solve, right? Because the number density of photons as a function of both space and time depends upon how many sources there are, that is stars and black holes, mainly. The number density of the hydrogen atoms itself will depend upon the cosmology. It will depend upon cosmology itself, right? And of course, the reionization process, because reionization itself will ionize away, and the neutral hydrogen will become ionized. So it will not just depend upon cosmology, but the reionization process itself. And the density, the availability of high density gas will again depend upon cosmology. So for example, on large scales, it doesn't matter. On small scales, for example, cold dark matter versus warm dark matter versus fuzzy dark matter will change the density structure on small scales. So cosmology itself will depend, will tell you how many recombinations will take place. So each of these simple terms that we wrote previously becomes a complicated astrophysics and cosmology, will depend upon complicated processes of both astrophysics and cosmology. And so that's why you need extremely sophisticated models to model the reionization process itself, okay? Okay, in addition to that, it's also a multi-scale process, because most of the photons that ionize the gas in the universe are generated, as I said, in stars or black holes. And most of this emission of these photons happens on subparsec scales. So GMC scales or the disk scales and the supermassive black holes in the center, then these photons somehow have to escape these GMCs. They have to go through the ISM of the galaxies that they are sitting in, which then has to go through the CGM of the galaxies, and then finally you interact with the gas on the IGM scales. So you have to go from parsec scales to kiloparsecs to megaparsecs to hundreds of megaparsecs, even gigaparsec scales. So it's not just a complicated process, it also has to go through multiple spatial scales in order to get photons to get to where they want in order to ionize the intergalactic medium itself. So you need to model this process somehow as well, right? So there are a lot of different models which try to do this. So I just examples. There are so many that I cannot put on one slide. So there are something called semi-numerical models, which are one example of that is 21 centimeter fast. If anybody has done 21 centimeter science, you would know about this, which is a semi-numerical model which kind of uses a very simple theory, very simple approximations to paint ionized regions around galaxies. This model is extremely good if you want to do efficient parameter exploration, because it's very fast, computationally efficient, right? But then the problem is, as I said, it's mainly painting edge to region, so you never really know if what you're doing is correct. You also have approximate source functions. You have to assume some escape fractions, because as I said, the photons are generated on subparsec scales, and they have to escape to megaparsec scales. So you need to account for escape fractions. You don't know what the clumping factor is, so you don't really know the density structure of the gas on these small scales. So you have to assume some clumping factors. So there are a lot of assumptions which go into this, but since it is fast, you can kind of get away with it. But the problem is, this is okay if you don't really know what parameter you're dealing with. So in order to go more get a bit more precise, people also use another class of models where they take hydrodynamical simulations and then they post-process these hydrodynamical simulations with radiative transfer. Okay, so that's a bit better, but you still have you still do not have the back reaction of radiation on galaxies itself. So the radiation from these galaxies can also affect galaxy formation, which is not really modeled in these class of models. And moreover, since you're post-processing it on large-scale simulations, your resolution is quite low. Usually these kinds of simulations have resolutions of hundreds of kiloparsecs or so. So you're still not really getting the self-shielded systems or the high-density regions, which can provide a lot of opacity to your photons. Okay. So while these kinds of models exist, there are still some drawbacks to these class of models. Okay. So, as I said, these previous class of models are good if you do not have a lot of idea about what the system is doing and you want to do an efficient parameter exploration. So that was the case until previously. So you just had Hubble looking at these high redshift galaxies before, and you had something like looking at AGNs and looking at the Gunn-Peterson trough in the AGN and Lyman alpha transmission in the AGN. So anything blueward of the Lyman alpha line, if you have an AGN sitting in the reionization epoch, it basically gets absorbed because of the neutral gas. But if you have some ionized gas, then you get these transmission spikes. So, you know, and looking at the statistics of the transmission spikes, you can say something about the reionization process itself. So you basically needed an AGN like skewers. You could only get the properties of the IGM along single skewers. That was the only possible way to do reionization science before. But both of these are changing. Of course, JWST and ALMA are currently giving us excellent eyes into this high redshift universe and telling us about the properties of the sources in a very nice manner. So you're able to constrain the properties of these first galaxies very well. And moreover, you're switching from single lines of sight to a full tomographic picture using something called line intensity mapping, and specifically line intensity mapping of the 21 centimeter line, which traces the spin flip transition in neutral hydrogen. So with this new intensity mapping experiments, you're no longer looking at single lines of sight. You can basically get a full tomographic picture using these kinds of intensity mapping experiments. Right now, we only have upper limits, but in the next 5 years or so, hopefully we'll get a full detection of the power spectrum during the reionization with instruments like HERA. So the main thing I want you to take away is that while these computationally efficient models were good in this epoch, where you had no idea about a lot of things for parameter extrapolation, you're going into a new high precision epoch. And if you want to do science in this high precision epoch, you need high precision theoretical models as well. And so that's where my simulations hopefully come in. So if you want to do high precision predictions for this reionization epoch, you need to have realistic structure formation models. Basically, you need to get your galaxies right. So you basically need to get star formation right, black hole formation right, and the emission of photons from these stars and black holes right. Okay. You need accurate radiation hydrodynamics because you need to couple the photons that these stars and black holes produce to the gas around these sources. And you need to cover a large dynamic range from parsecs to hundreds of megaparsec scales because all these scales are important in order to model the reionization process itself, okay? So that's where the Thiessen simulations come in. These are extremely large volume, high resolution, coupled reionization and galaxy formation simulations. Which were put out last year. So these are the papers if you want to look at that I led. And here you can see the large scale properties, about 100 megaparsec. You're looking at the temperature map here in the background. So blue is low temperature and yellow is high temperature. And as you can see, you're going from redshift 16 to redshift 5.5. The universe is almost fully ionized, okay, in this simulation. And then you can zoom in on one small region there, and you can look at different properties like the density structure, metallicity structure, star formation rate, etc. And you can zoom in even more, and you can look at individual galaxies themselves. And this is a mock JWST galaxy and a mock ALMA galaxy from this simulation. So you can go from large-scale structure to individual galaxies. So this is the first time these kinds of simulations have been able to do predictions for both galaxy formation and reionization itself. Right. And this got, somehow, even the Scientific American took up and wrote about their simulations, which we were very happy about. And of course, it has to be record-breaking in their sense in order to, but yeah, it's just, yeah, it's just nice simulation. But if you wanted to write it in Scientific American, I suppose you have to add some terms in between, in the front. Anyway, so the reason why it was so good, the simulations were good, is because we kind of coupled a well-tested galaxy formation model, which is called Illustrious TNG. So there have, you know, there have been hundreds of papers on Illustrious TNG recently. So they make predictions for galaxies down to redshift zero. So we took that galaxy formation model, which has been quite good at redshift zero, and we coupled it to an efficient radiation hydrodynamics solver that I wrote called AREPO-RT. And this scales, this is a very extremely efficient and scalable radiation hydrodynamics solver. So I should say that these simulations do not, so these Illustrious TNG simulations themselves do not model the effect of radiation. And the new thing we did was to include the effect of radiation using the model that Illustrious TNG has. So it does both. That's the idea, right? and so just to get, tell you an idea about where these simulations stand in this box size versus cell size. So basically what you're trying to say, show here is that if you, you need a large box in these simulations to model a large area of your universe, and you need to have low cell size or very high resolution in order to go to the parsec scales in order to understand how the photons interact with these galaxies. So the, here is a set of simulations that I've placed here. So most, either these simulations have very low box size, very small box and high resolution, or very large box and very low resolution. And we are around here. So we have a large box and a very high resolution as well, which will allow us to do galaxy formation and reionization. And so it was a significant computational effort. We ran it on about 57,600 compute cores. And it took about 30 million CPU hours to do this. But we got a lot of nice results from the simulation. It's not just computation, we also got nice physics results, and that's what I'll be showing you. I'll be showing in the next few slides here. So on the left, here I show the ionization history. So the neutral fraction in the IGM of galaxies as a function of redshift. The as I said, the observations are all over the place. So the fact that it goes through the observations is nothing really that important, but it's just to say that we are right around where the observations tell us the a neutral fraction should evolve. But on the left is a more important plot, which shows, on the right, sorry, is a more important plot which shows the mean free path evolution of Lyman continuum photons as a function of redshift. Okay, so previously, previous models predicted that the mean free path should go as 1 plus z to the minus 5.4. That's the dashed line there. But we showed that in our simulations, actually, it's much, much steeper. And these points came after we put this result in, right? So these observational points came after we put this result in. So we basically predicted that the Lyman continuum mean free path evolution should be much steeper than what previous people have said. And recent observations actually tell us that this is correct. You actually have a very steep evolution of the mean free path before it flattens off. Okay, and the, yeah, there's a question.
So, for actual attribute. But like on the left plot, like you have also Irvine, like Fourier simulation, and like I see some points at the bottom, like at the
here.
Bottom. Yeah.
Right. So our simulation stopped here. We didn't go any further. But if we had gone further, it would come to the bottom and go down. I can show you. So this, so we already, our computing time allowed us to go up to here. We couldn't go a bit further in the redshift, that's all. Yeah. But we went with low resolution, and with low resolution simulations, we did go down to here and then flatten off. Okay. What was it? Yeah. So again, and the reason why we think that we get this steep evolution in the mean free path is because we prefer a late reionization model for one, which just seems to be preferred by recent observations as well. So previously people thought reionization completed by redshift 6, but we think in order to match these observations, you need reionization to complete down to redshift 5.5 or 5.2 or something like this. And the other thing is, because of our high resolution, you have these high density self-shielded regions, which can be seen here. So we have such a high resolution that you have these high density self-shielded regions. Even if the large volume is ionized, you still have these high density regions, which are self-shielded against photons. And this provide additional, these high density regions provide additional opacity, which reduces your mean free path, okay? If you do simulations which are not high resolution, then all of this is one single cell, and it gets averaged out, and you no longer get these high density regions, so your mean free path evolution will be much shallower. So the reason why we get this very steep mean free path evolution is also because we are able to resolve these individual high density regions, okay? These filaments and knots. And these knots and filaments, even if there is a background, will be self-shielded against this photon background. And that's the reason why you get this steep evolution in the mean free path. And I would say recent simulations which from other groups who have also tried to resolve this also get this steep evolution now, okay? So recently it has been shown that if you get enough resolution and if you resolve this, you can probably get this steep evolution. Oh, sorry, go back. Yeah. Okay. So it's not just reionization properties. We also get the, because we are using the well-tested galaxy formation model, illustrious TNG, it is not a surprise that we get the properties of the galaxies themselves correct, right? So this is showing the star formation efficiency on the y-axis as a function of halo mass. And these are results from abundance matching techniques from Peter Beruzzi. Sorry, that's the blue line there. And the black lines are the Thiessen simulations. And we kind of follow what abundance matching tell us. But other simulations which try to do this either have very high star formation rates or star formation rates which flatten out. And this is important because now, you know, the escape fractions will be very different. So the derived escape fractions will be very different if your star formation itself is too high, right? So that's why it's important to get the sources correct as well, okay? another result I would like to highlight is the connection between the IGM and the galaxies themselves. So again, we are looking at spectra of AGN. In the reionization epoch, as I said, if you have any kind of neutral hydrogen, because the cross-section of Lyman alpha is so high, it'll get absorbed, right? So anything blueward of the Lyman alpha line will be absorbed. But you have these, again, transmission spikes, and these are ionized regions around galaxies. So if you imagine you have an AGN light going through the neutral IGM, as soon as you hit an ionized region around a galaxy, you'll have a spike because it is ionized. And these are these transmission spikes, okay? And by looking at these transmission spikes, you can say something about how ionized or neutral the gas is. And so we can make predictions as well. So again, it's the same thing. We are in our simulation, which take a skewer around this in this simulation box, and we look at the spikes in the transmission of Lyman alpha. And the very most important thing is we can actually say which galaxy caused this particular spike, right? So you can say, okay, this spike was caused by this galaxy. The photons from this galaxy ionizing the region around it, and that is what is causing the spikes around this galaxy, right? And that's what is important, because now you can say, okay, now you can not only look at the IGM in a statistical manner, you can actually go to each individual transmission spike and say what is the property of the galaxy which is causing this spike to happen, right? And so this is important because these are all mock JWST images, and there are JWST people with GTO teams looking at this right now. Sorry, go ahead.
So are you using this to get like simulations of like the 21 centimeter forest to like different sort of skewer lines of sight to get what you can
map? Yeah, so what we do is we take the simulation, we run a skewer through it, we look at the Lyman alpha transmission, and then because it's a simulation, we know which galaxy caused that spike. And so that's what's plotted here. Yeah. Okay, so that was in a qualitative manner. We can quantify it a little bit more. So this is on the y-axis showing the normalized Lyman alpha transmission flux as a function of distance from the central galaxy. Okay, so if you are close to the central galaxy, there's a lot of neutral gas, which is high density, so it should be self-shielded. So your Lyman alpha transmission will be lower than the mean Lyman alpha transmission. If you are a bit at intermediate ranges, then the photons from the galaxy itself will ionize the region surrounding it much more than the average ionization of the IGM. And so you should have a spike in the Lyman alpha transmission. So you should have more transmission than the median. At large distances, your average ionization is equal to the average ionization in your whole universe. And so it will fall off to the median. Okay? So basically, that's what you should see. You should have low transmission close to the galaxy, high transmission, higher than median transmission at intermediate distances, and then mean at large distances. So previous simulations have tried this. That's the purple croc simulations from Nick Nedden's group. And they never get this high transmission in the intermediate regimes, whereas we do, right? So you actually get low, high, and then median again. That's the red line. Yeah, that's the red line there, okay? And the reason is because of a better physics and better radiation coupling, right? So as I showed before, these kinds of simulations get the galaxy properties wrong, and they're not forming enough photons to actually over-ionize the intermediate distances, right? They only ionize till the mean, and then it falls off, right? So that's why we get this right as well. And it's not just this. Recent JWST observations have also confirmed this modulation. So this is from the first JWST observations. They're looking at normalized Lyman alpha transmission as a function of distance from the galaxy. And at a particular transmission rate, you see this. You have low transmission, high transmission, and then it falls off. And they compare their data to our Thiessen simulations, and we also kind of get this behavior, right? So new JWST observations have confirmed this kind of behavior from our simulations as well, okay? Okay, so next, I'll talk a little bit about some other results. So here we are looking at till now we talked about how galaxies ionize the IGM, but the ionized IGM will also have an impact on the galaxies itself, especially on low mass galaxies, right? So if you have a galaxy with a virial temperature less than 10,000 Kelvin, then the reionization process itself can stop star formation, right? So this is what we show here. So mainly, most of the simulations use a constant UV background model to mimic this, okay? So at a certain redshift, they turn on the background, and all the galaxies below a certain mass is fully ionized, okay? So that's this bottom panel here. On the top, we actually go through the reionization using full radiation hydrodynamic simulations. And what we are showing is the metallicity of the stars that are formed, okay? So if you have a UV uniform UV background, what happens is that it stops star formation in all small halos. So these primordial halos are immediately stops forming stars. So the POP3 star formation is immediately stopped because it's all the star formation happens in high mass galaxies which are already metal enriched. Whereas if you have this very patchy reionization process which is not immediate, then what can happen is that you might have regions where which do not see the radiation field yet. And these primordial small halos keep forming stars and keep forming pristine stars. So you can have population 3 star formation. Even though it's subdominant, you can still have POP3 star formation all the way down to redshift 6s. Okay? So the reionization model that you have can have very big implications for what JWST will see. Again, this is just a first study, and we are trying to figure out what this all means for JWST. Okay. Another thing is about escape fractions. I talked about that, and we said we had no idea, and we do not. So here are two different semi-analytic models for escape fractions. The pink model is where high-mass galaxies contribute to the reionization process, and the blue model is where low-mass galaxies contribute to the reionization process. And both kind of fit well. This paper claims that the high-mass galaxies contributing fit the data better, but you know, it's not at a very high level. You cannot really distinguish between these two models. But we showed that at high redshifts, low-mass galaxies contribute. At low redshifts, high-mass galaxies start to take over. Okay, so if you're looking at the very high redshifts below 9 or 10, then low-mass galaxies contribute most of your photons to reionization. But as you go lower and lower, high-mass galaxies start to dominate your photon budget. Okay, so this is somewhere in between. So you have the blue model at high redshift, and then the pink at low redshifts, right? So we can make predictions for the escape fractions. So. Okay, then I talked about the bubble sizes. So I said about 21 centimeter line intensity mapping. So as I said, it'll give you a tomographic picture. By tomographic picture, what I mean is hopefully, 20, 30 years, SKA will be able to actually map out the ionized bubbles during the reionization epoch. That's the idea. Okay. So here, I show two simulations from the Thiessen box. One is where small galaxies dominate your reionization. And this is where high-mass galaxies, massive galaxies dominate your reionization. The point is the volume average neutral fraction is the same in both. So it's 30% ionized in both cases. But you can see the bubble sizes, the statistics of the bubble sizes are very, very different, right? So just by looking at the statistics of the bubble sizes, you can say something about which sources are responsible for the reionization process itself, okay? Of course, if you can get this map using SKA, that's fine. But the first thing you'll get with HERA are the power spectrum. I won't go into this here. So just by looking at the differences in the power spectrum, you can say something about which process is dominating. So as I showed here, I'm just taking the power spectrum of these bubbles. But now I convolve it with the density field, because that's what 21 centimeter will see. So the red line is large galaxies, and the blue is small galaxies. And I also plot an alternative dark matter model here. And you can see the power spectrum on large scales is especially different for these three different models. So HERA, yeah?
What's the alternative dark matter model?
This is a self-interacting dark matter. Yeah, model. Just through a change in the linear matter power spectrum. We don't really simulate the self-interactions. Yeah. And just by looking at the slope of the power spectrum on large scales, you can say something about the what sources are responsible, and even maybe place constraints on dark matter itself. Okay. So as I said, not just 21 centimeter, but there are also other line intensity mapping experiments which are about to come along. So 21 centimeter will map the reionization process. But C2, CO, and all these emission lines like O3, Lyman alpha, H beta will map the galaxies themselves, okay? So you have 21 centimeter telling you how reionization is progressing. You have other emission lines telling you about the star formation in galaxies. So if you can map both, you have the complete picture, right? Because this will tell you what stars are doing. That is telling you what the radiation from these stars are, how it is affecting the IGM itself. So if you can cross-correlate one of these emission lines with the 21 centimeter, you get the full picture of the reionization processes. And you know, there are first detections of C2 and CO at low redshift already from CCAT prime and COMAP, all these measurements. So hopefully in the next five to 10 years, you'll have a complete picture of emission lines from these galaxies also, okay? So you can basically cross-correlate them and tell you, say something about the sources and the reionization process itself, okay? So we kind of made predictions for that. Because we have galaxies, it's not just a large-scale simulations, but you also have individual properties of galaxies, you can actually make predictions for how the SCDs from these galaxies will look like, and that's what we did on the top there. So that's an SCD of one of the galaxies. So with the emission lines, like O2, H beta, O3, H alpha, and even infrared emission lines like O3 and C2, and you can make predictions for how these emission lines will look like, okay? And so what happens is you can make maps like this. You can make 21 centimeter maps, so predictions for 21 centimeter experiments like HERA. You can also make H alpha, Lyman alpha maps, which will be probed by instruments like SphereX, okay? So that is the IGM, this is the galaxies, right? Because H alpha is from stars, and that is the IGM itself, okay? So you can make maps like this, and then cross-correlate those two to tell you something about what the reionization is doing, okay? So again, here I show the cross-correlation power spectrum. For a model, reionization model, where large galaxies dominate, blue is small galaxies, and that's, again, the alternative dark matter. And you can see the place where the cross-correlation goes from positive to negative, that's the transition scale, is different for different models. So just by probing the transition scale, you can say something about which sources are responsible for the reionization process. Okay? So Thiessen is able to make predictions for these kinds of observations as well. Okay, so in the last 10 minutes, I'll just show there are a lot of nice things about Thiessen, you know, but of course it's not the ultimate model, and you want to make improvements to these simulations, and I will just tell you about some of the recent improvements that we have been trying to make in order to make our simulations better. So the first thing you must know is that all this illustrious TNG and Thiessen and even Eagle, most of these large-scale simulations cannot resolve the high-density gas. So anything above 0.1 particles per cc, it cannot really resolve this high-density gas. So what it does is instead it kind of assumes an effective equation of state. And then using this effective equation of state, you say, okay, we don't really care about the processes going on here. We just care about the large scale properties. So they do get the large scale properties right. But if you want to talk about the ISM of galaxies, you cannot really do that using this model. Okay. So the question is, can you improve that, right? And why do you want to improve that? Well, this is a plot from Roberto Maialino, where he shows the different emission lines that JWST and ALMA will detect. This was a prediction line 2012. I don't know how it stacks up to recent JWST observation. Anyway, the point is you'll see a lot of emission line measurements like O3, H alpha, Lyman alpha, O2, CO, C2. All these will be measured by these instruments from high redshift galaxies, okay? And if you want to make predictions for these emission lines, you need to model the high-density gas in these galaxies because that's where these lines come from, right? So if you want to make predictions for these lines, you need to model the high-density gas in galaxies. You cannot say it's an equation of state, right? So that's where these the smuggle model comes in, where we model the multiphase ISM gas, but with full radiative transfer and dust physics included. Okay, so we model dust grain, dust formation and destruction. We model H2 formation on dust grains, and we also model the radiation field. So you can actually say what the ionization structure and the temperature structure of the gas is in this high density gas is. Okay, so we can show how the phase space structure changes. So as I said previously, this box here, you basically modeled it with a effective equation of state. Now with this new model, you actually get the full phase space structure of gas. So you get the cold high density gas, you get the photoionized gas, so you have stars forming in this high density gas, and then you have this photo H2 regions which heat up the gas to about 10,000 Kelvin also. So, and everything in between, right? It's not just cold and hot gas, but you get cold, hot, and everything in between, right? So you get the full phase space structure of the gas in galaxies. And so what you can do is you can do these cool things where if you can, for example, you can look at one region that say that's IR bright. This is not post-processing the simulation. IR bright, and then as you evolve, the stars clear out that region and becomes and then explode and becomes UV bright. So all the processes which is seen in nearby galaxies for star formation, H2 regions, and supernova feedback, all this is happening in this kind of a, you know, this is a simulation, right? And we can track all of these here. Again, as I said, you can also model the dust to gas ratio and the dust temperature using these kinds of simulations. And what you can do, as I said, is that it's important to get the emission lines. So now that you have correct gas density, well, accurate gas density, temperature, dust, and the ionization fractions, what you can do is model emission lines self-consistently. So you no longer need to assume some ionization parameter or something like that in order to model the emission lines. You can take all of this and self-consistently get like an H-alpha map, for example. Right? That's what's shown here. Okay. So now because JWST measures all these properties, you can make direct predictions for the what JWST will see. Okay, I won't go into that, but I will say that, you know, and it is important we do this and not just rely on stuff like Cloudy, because I'll just quote one of the JWST papers here, where they had to mask off an O3 line, so they are trying to fit an SED. Through the JWST observations, but they have to mask off these O3 line because the fluxes were too high and none of their Cloudy-based models could really model this O3 line. They did not know what parameters you need to get this very high, very, very bright O3 line, right? So the Cloudy doesn't do a good job here. So that's why we are also including metal emission lines. So from the same simulations where I showed H-alpha, now you can also do emission lines like C2, C3, all the different metal emission lines that JWST will be, because we'll see, we can forward model that using these kinds of simulations, okay? So we can make predictions for JWST and ALMA as well, okay? And this is important for line intensity mapping that I showed before, for like Sphere X, right? Because they are looking at these lines, but in a much more, not like from individual galaxies, but from an average sense. These kinds of simulations with these metal emission lines will go in some way in telling you how these line intensity mapping experiments will look like. So this is helpful for both galaxy surveys like JWST and line intensity mapping surveys, okay? Okay. I don't know if people are interested in numerics, but we are also making improvements to the radiation hydrodynamics algorithms. So if you want to come and talk to me, you can talk to me about that. Okay. And finally, I will say that JWST seems to be, the recent JWST results seem to be in tension with what we know about galaxy formation. So here's a JWST Sears paper from Steve Finkelstein. This is the surface density of some of galaxies greater than this magnitude as a function of redshift, and all the simulation results kind of lie here, whereas the observations are here, almost all simulation results. And there seems to be some amount of tension between what simulations predict and what JWST sees. JWST actually sees a lot of luminous galaxies at these redshifts. So it's almost all galaxy formation theories are in tension with what JWST sees right now. So there are many plausible explanations for this. People have suggested changing the IMF, primordial black holes, population 3 stars, or even the fact that because JWST is so new, you really do not know if you're actually how to model the fluxes from the JWST. All of these can be solutions, but the point is you need to figure out which one is the right answer, and I do not have an answer to this. I don't think anybody has an answer to this yet, but it's quite interesting, and so that's the future work that we want to do, right? So include better prescriptions, model POP3 stars, model the role of Lyman-Werner feedback on the very first stars and galaxies, or even if you need different dark matter and dark energy models in order to explain the tension between JWST and observations, okay? So to conclude, there's a whole slew of instruments that are coming online, which will give a wealth of high redshift observational data. In fact, new JWST data seems to be in tension with standard galaxy formation theories and lambda CDM. So it's in fact imperative we have very accurate theoretical / numerical models to make use of this data, get full potential out of this data. And I would say Thiessen is one such simulation framework which aims to provide accurate simulation counterpart to these observations of this early universe. So thank you.
A naive question. So in your simulations, how do you model the star formation rate and the emission from supermassive black holes?
How do I model star formation? What's the second one?
And the emission from supermassive black holes.
Yeah, so the star formation rate, it's a very simple prescription. So gas above a certain density converts to star on a certain time scale. Parameterization doesn't really affect the properties of the galaxies. What affects is the feedback. And the feedback from these stars and black holes are tuned to match redshift zero kind of observations. Okay? And we get the galaxy, so that's the tuning that we do. So we tune the model such that we match the properties of galaxies, stars, and black holes at around redshift zero.
Yeah, I guess I have kind of a similar but more open-ended question. I was wondering if you could give us a sense for how many parameter choices go into these simulations.
Yeah.
When you show agreement with data, some of that agreement is because there are parameter choices that are chosen to match our observations.
Sure. There are two parts to this. One is the galaxy formation model. And there are quite a few parameters, I would say, order of 10 or so, which are tuned to match the low redshift UV luminosity function, stellar mass function, and stellar to halo mass ratio. Okay. So you match those three, and everything else you get is kind of a prediction. Okay. On the reionization part, one parameter we tune is kind of a subgrid escape fraction to get about the right value of right end of the reionization. Okay, that's one parameter that we tune. Okay, everything else like the mean free path evolution is a prediction. Okay, so you cannot make predictions for the parameters you tuned on, but you can make predictions for the things that you did not tune on. That's the idea. Yep.
Okay, there are no more questions.
Thank you. Thanks.